Chapter 29 Continued. Harry, what happened? According to Hagrid, you were with Professor Dumbledore when it happened. He says Professor Snape was involved in some... Snape killed Dumbledore, said Harry. She stared at him for a moment, then swayed alarmingly. Madame Pomfrey, who seemed to have pulled herself together, ran forwards, conjuring a chair from thin air, which she pushed under McGonagall. "Snape!" repeated McGonagall faintly, falling into the chair. "We all wondered, but he trusted. Always. Snape! I can't believe it." "Snape was a highly accomplished Occlumens," said Lupin, his voice uncharacteristically harsh. "We always knew that."
"But Dumbledore swore he was on our side," whispered Tonks. "I always thought Dumbledore must know something about Snape that we didn't."
"He always hinted that he had an ironclad reason for trusting Snape," muttered Professor McGonagall, now dabbing at the corners of her leaking eyes with a tartan-edged handkerchief. "I mean, with Snape's history, of course people were bound to wonder. But Dumbledore told me explicitly that Snape's repentance was absolutely genuine, wouldn't hear a word against him."
"I'd love to know what Snape told him to convince him," said Tonks.
"I know," said Harry, and they all turned to stare at him. "Snape passed Voldemort the information that made Voldemort hunt down my mum and dad. Then... Snape told Dumbledore he hadn't realised what he was doing. He was really sorry he'd done it. Sorry that they were dead."
"And Dumbledore believed that?" said Lupin incredulously. "Dumbledore believed Snape was sorry James was dead. Snape hated James."
"And he didn't think my mother was worth a damn either," said Harry, "because she was muggle-born. Mudblood, he called her." Nobody asked how Harry knew this. All of them seemed to be lost in horrified shock, trying to digest the monstrous truth of what had happened.
"This is all my fault,"
said Professor McGonagall suddenly. She looked disorientated, twisting her wet handkerchief in her hands.
"My fault. I sent Filius to fetch Snape tonight. I actually sent for him to come and help us. If I hadn't alerted Snape to what was going on, he might never have joined forces with the Death Eaters. I don't think he knew they were there before Filius told him. I don't think he knew they were coming."
"It isn't your fault, Minerva," said Lupin firmly. "We all wanted more help. We were glad to think Snape was on his way. So when he arrived at the fight, he joined in on the Death Eaters' side?" asked Harry, who wanted every detail of Snape's duplicity and infamy, feverishly collecting more reasons to hate him, to swear vengeance.
"I don't know exactly how it happened," said Professor McGonagall distractedly. "It's all so confusing. Dumbledore had told us that he would be leaving the school for a few hours, and that we were to patrol the corridors just in case. Remus, Bill, and Nymphadora were to join us, and so we patrolled. All seemed quiet. Every secret passageway out of the school was covered. We knew nobody could fly in. There were powerful enchantments on every entrance into the castle. I still don't know how the Death Eaters can possibly have entered."
"I do," said Harry, and he explained briefly about the pair of vanishing cabinets and the magical pathway they formed. "So they got in through the Room of Requirement." Almost against his will, he glanced from Ron to Hermione, both of whom looked devastated.
"I messed up, Harry," said Ron bleakly. "We did like you told us. We checked the Marauder's map, and we couldn't see Malfoy on it, so we thought he must be in the Room of Requirement. So me, Ginny and Neville went to keep watch on it. But Malfoy got past us.
He came out of the room about an hour after we started keeping watch," said Ginny. "He was on his own, clutching that awful shrivelled arm.
"His hand of glory," said Ron, "gives light only to the holder, remember?"
"Anyway," Ginny went on, "he must have been checking whether the coast was clear to let the Death Eaters out, because the moment he saw us he threw something into the air and it all went pitch black."
"Peruvian instant darkness powder," said Ron bitterly. "Fred and George's. I'm going to be having a word with them about who they let buy their products."
"We tried everything. Lumos, Incendio," said Ginny. "Nothing would penetrate the darkness. All we could do was grope our way out of the corridor again, and meanwhile we could hear people brushing past us. Obviously Malfoy could see because of that hand thing and was guiding them, but we didn't dare use any curses or anything in case we hit each other. And by the time we'd reached a corridor that was light, they'd gone."
"Luckily," said Lupin hoarsely. "Ron, Ginny, and Neville ran into us almost immediately and told us what had happened. We found the Death Eaters minutes later, heading in the direction of the Astronomy Tower.
Malfoy obviously hadn't expected more people to be on the watch. He seemed to have exhausted his supply of darkness powder, at any rate. A fight broke out, they scattered, and we gave chase. One of them, Gibbon, broke away and headed up the tower stairs."
"To set off the mark?" asked Harry.
"He must have done, yes. They must have arranged that before they left the Room of Requirement," said Lupin. "But I don't think Gibbon liked the idea of waiting up there alone for Dumbledore, because he came running back downstairs to rejoin the fight, and was hit by a killing curse that just missed me."
"So if Ron was watching the Room of Requirement with Ginny and Neville," said Harry, turning to Hermione, "were you—"
"Outside Snape's office, yes,"
whispered Hermione, her eyes sparkling with tears.
"With Luna. We hung around for ages outside it, and nothing happened. We didn't know what was going on upstairs. Ron had taken the Marauder's map. It was nearly midnight when Professor Flitwick came sprinting down into the dungeons. He was shouting about Death Eaters in the castle. I don't think he really registered that Luna and I were there at all. He just burst his way into Snape's office, and we heard him saying that Snape had to go back with him and help. And then we heard a loud thump, and Snape came hurtling out of his room, and he saw us, and—"
"What?" Harry urged her.
"I was so stupid, Harry," said Hermione in a high-pitched whisper. "He said Professor Flitwick had collapsed, and that we should go and take care of him while he went to help fight the Death Eaters."
She covered her face in shame and continued to talk into her fingers so that her voice was muffled.
"We went into his office to see if we could help Professor Flitwick, and found him unconscious on the floor. And oh, it's so obvious now. Snape must have stupefied Flitwick, but we didn't realise, Harry, we didn't realise. We just let Snape go."
"It's not your fault," said Lupin firmly. "Hermione, had you not obeyed Snape and got out of the way, he would probably have killed you and Luna." "So then he came upstairs," said Harry, who in his mind's eye was watching Snape running up the marble staircase, his black robes billowing behind him as ever, pulling his wand from under his cloak as he ascended. "And he found the place where you were all fighting."
"We were in trouble. We were losing," said Tonks in a low voice. "Gibbon was down, but the rest of the Death Eaters seemed ready to fight to the death. Neville had been hurt. Bill had been savaged by Greyback. It was all dark, curses flying everywhere. The Malfoy boy had vanished. He must have slipped past up the stairs to the tower. Then more of them ran after him, but one of them blocked the stairs behind them with some kind of curse. Neville ran at it and got thrown up into the air."
"None of us could break through," said Ron. "And that massive Death Eater was still firing off jinxes all over the place. They were bouncing off the walls and barely missing us."
"And then Snape was there," said Tonks.
"And then he wasn't. I saw him running towards us, but that huge Death Eater's jinx just missed me right afterwards, and I ducked and lost track of things," said Ginny.
"'I saw him run straight through the cursed barrier as though it wasn't there,' said Lupin. "'I tried to follow him, but was thrown back, just like Neville.'
"'He must have known a spell we didn't,' whispered McGonagall. "'After all, he was the Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher. "'I just assumed that he was in a hurry to chase after the Death Eaters who'd escaped up to the tower.'
"'He was,' said Harry savagely. "'But to help them, not to stop them. "'And I'll bet you had to have a dark mark to get through that barrier. "'So what happened when he came back down?'
"'Well,' The big Death Eater had just fired off a hex that caused half the ceiling to fall in, and also broke the curse blocking the stairs, said Lupin. We all ran forwards, those of us who were still standing, anyway, and then Snape and the boy emerged out of the dust. Obviously none of us attacked them.
We just let them pass, said Tonks in a hollow voice. We thought they were being chased by the Death Eaters, "'And next thing the other Death Eaters and Greyback were back "'and we were fighting again. "'I thought I heard Snape shout something, but I don't know what.'
"'He shouted, "'It's over,' said Harry. "'He'd done what he'd meant to do.' "'They all fell silent. "'Fawkes's lament was still echoing over the dark grounds outside. "'As the music reverberated upon the air, unbidden, unwelcome thoughts slunk into Harry's mind. Had they taken Dumbledore's body from the foot of the tower yet? What would happen to it next? Where would it rest? He clenched his fists tightly in his pockets. He could feel the small cold lump of the fake Horcrux against the knuckles of his right hand. The doors of the hospital wing burst open, making them all jump. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley were striding up the ward, Fleur just behind them, her beautiful face terrified.
"'Molly! Arthur!'
said Professor McGonagall, jumping up and hurrying to greet them.
"'I am so sorry!'
"'Bill!'
whispered Mrs. Weasley, darting past Professor McGonagall as she caught sight of Bill's mangled face.
"'Oh, Bill!'
Lupin and Tonks had got up hastily and retreated, so that Mr. and Mrs. Weasley could get nearer to the bed. Mrs. Weasley bent over her son and pressed her lips to his bloody forehead.
"'You said Greyback attacked him?'
Mr. Weasley asked Professor McGonagall distractedly.
"'But he hadn't transformed. So what does that mean? What will happen to Bill?'
"'We don't yet know,'
said Professor McGonagall, looking helplessly at Lupin.
"'There will probably be some contamination, Arthur,' said Lupin. "'It is an odd case, possibly unique. "'We don't know what his behaviour might be like when he wakes up.'
Mrs. Weasley took the nasty-smelling ointment from Madame Pumphrey and began dabbing at Bill's wounds.
"'And Dumbledore?' said Mr. Weasley. "'Minerva, is it true? Is he really?'
As Professor McGonagall nodded, Harry felt Ginny move beside him and looked at her. Her slightly narrowed eyes were fixed upon Fleur, who was gazing down at Bill with a frozen expression on her face.
"'Dumbledore? Gone?'
whispered Mr. Weasley. But Mrs. Weasley had eyes only for her eldest son. She began to sob, tears falling onto Bill's mutilated face.
"'Of course it doesn't matter how he looks. It's not really important, but he was a very handsome little boy, always very handsome, and he was going to be married.'
"'And what do you mean by that?'
said Fleur, suddenly and loudly.
"'What do you mean, he was going to be married?'
Mrs. Weasley raised her tear-stained face, looking startled.
"'Well, only that—'
"'You think Bill will not wish to marry me any more?' demanded Fleur. "'You think, because of these bites, he will not love me?'
"'No, that's not what I—'
"'Because he will,' said Fleur, drawing herself up to her full height and throwing back her long mane of silver hair. "It would take more than a werewolf to stop Bill loving me."
"Well, yes, I'm sure," said Mrs. Weasley. "But I thought perhaps, given how he—"
"You thought I would not wish to marry him? Or perhaps you hoped," said Fleur, her nostrils flaring. "What do I care how he looks? I am good-looking enough for both of us, I think. All these scars show is that my husband is brave. And I shall do that," she added fiercely, pushing Mrs. Weasley aside and snatching the ointment from her. Mrs. Weasley fell back against her husband and watched Fleur mopping up Bill's wounds with a most curious expression upon her face. Nobody said anything. Harry did not dare move. Like everybody else, he was waiting for the explosion. "Our great Auntie Muriel," said Mrs. Weasley after a long pause, "has a very beautiful tiara, goblin made, which I am sure I could persuade her to lend you for the wedding. She's very fond of Bill, you know, and it would look lovely with your hair."
"Thank you," said Fleur stiffly. "I am sure that will be lovely."
And then Harry did not quite see how it happened. Both women were crying and hugging each other, completely bewildered, wondering whether the world had gone mad. He turned round. Ron looked as stunned as Harry felt, and Ginny and Hermione were exchanging startled looks.
"You see?"
said a strained voice. Tonks was glaring at Lupin.
"She still wants to marry him, even though he's been bitten. She doesn't care."
"It's different," said Lupin, barely moving his lips and looking suddenly tense. "Bill will not be a full werewolf. The cases are completely—"
"But I don't care either. I don't care,"
said Tonks, seizing the front of Lupin's robes and shaking them.
"I've told you a million times."
And the meaning of Tonks's Patronus and her mouse-coloured hair and the reason she had come running to find Dumbledore when she had heard a rumour someone had been attacked by Greyback, all suddenly became clear to Harry. It had not been serious that Tonks had fallen in love with after all.
"And I've told you a million times," said Lupin,
refusing to meet her eyes, staring at the floor, "that I am too old for you, too poor, too dangerous."
"I've said all along you're taking a ridiculous line on this, Remus," said Mrs. Weasley over Fleur's shoulder as she patted her on the back.
"I'm not being ridiculous," said Lupin steadily. "Tonks deserves somebody young and whole."
"But she wants you,"
said Mr. Weasley with a small smile.
"And after all, Remus, young and whole men do not necessarily remain so."
He gestured sadly at his son lying between them.
"This is not the moment to discuss it," said Lupin, avoiding everybody's eyes as he looked around distractedly. "Dumbledore is dead."
"Dumbledore would have been happier than anybody to think that there was a little more love in the world," said Professor McGonagall curtly, just as the hospital doors opened again and Hagrid walked in.
The little of his face that was not obscured by hair or beard was soaking and swollen. He was shaking with tears, a vast spotted handkerchief in his hand.
"I've done it, Professor," he choked. "Moved him. Professor Sprout's got the kids back in bed. Professor Flitwick's lying down, but he says he'll be all right in a jiffy. And Professor Slughorn says the Ministry's been informed."
"Thank you, Hagrid,"
said Professor McGonagall, standing up at once and turning to look at the group around Bill's bed.
"I shall have to see the Ministry when they get here. Hagrid, please tell the heads of house—Slughorn can represent Slytherin—
that I want to see them in my office forthwith. I would like you to join us too." As Hagrid nodded, turned, and shuffled out of the room again, she looked down at Harry. "Before I meet them, I would like a quick word with you, Harry, if you'll come with me." Harry stood up, murmured, "See you in a bit," to Ron, Hermione, and Ginny, and followed Professor McGonagall back down the ward. The corridors outside were deserted, and the only sound was the distant phoenix song. It was several minutes before Harry became aware that they were not heading for Professor McGonagall's office, but for Dumbledore's, and another few seconds before he realized that, of course, she had been deputy headmistress. Apparently she was now headmistress, so the room behind the gargoyle was now hers. In silence they ascended the moving spiral staircase and entered the circular office. He did not know what he had expected, that the room would be draped in black, perhaps, or even that Dumbledore's body might be lying there. In fact, it looked almost exactly as it had done when he and Dumbledore had left it mere hours previously, the silver instruments whirring and puffing on their spindle-legged tables, Gryffindor's sword in its glass case gleaming in the moonlight, the sorting hat on a shelf behind the desk. But Fawkes's perch stood empty. He was still crying his lament to the grounds, and a new portrait had joined the ranks of the dead headmasters and headmistresses of Hogwarts. Dumbledore was slumbering in a golden frame over the desk, his half-moon spectacles perched upon his crooked nose, looking peaceful and untroubled. After glancing once at this portrait, Professor McGonagall made an odd movement as though steeling herself, then rounded the desk to look at Harry, her face taut and lined. "Harry," she said, "I would like to know what you and Professor Dumbledore were doing this evening when you left the school." "I can't tell you that, Professor," said Harry. He had expected the question and had his answer ready. It had been here, in this very room, that Dumbledore had told him that he was to confide the contents of their lessons to nobody but Ron and Hermione. "Harry, it might be important," said Professor McGonagall. "It is," said Harry. "Very. But he didn't want me to tell anyone." Professor McGonagall glared at him. "Potter," Harry registered the renewed use of his surname, "in the light of Professor Dumbledore's death, I think you must see that the situation has changed somewhat." "I don't think so," said Harry, shrugging. "Professor Dumbledore never told me to stop following his orders if he died." "But there's one thing you should know before the Ministry gets here, though. Madame Rosmerta's under the Imperius curse. She was helping Malfoy and the Death Eaters. That's how the necklace and the poisoned mead..." "Rosmerta?" said Professor McGonagall incredulously. But before she could go on, there was a knock on the door behind them, and Professors Sprout, Flitwick, and Slughorn traipsed into the room, followed by Hagrid, who was still weeping copiously, his huge frame trembling with grief. "Snape!" ejaculated Slughorn, who looked the most shaken, pale, and sweating. "Snape! I taught him! I thought I knew him!" But before any of them could respond to this, a sharp voice spoke from high on the wall. A sallow-faced wizard with a short black fringe had just walked back into his empty canvas. "Minerva, the minister will be here within seconds. He has just disapparated from the ministry." "Thank you, Everard," said Professor McGonagall, and she turned quickly to her teachers. "I want to talk about what happens to Hogwarts before he gets here," she said quickly. "Personally, I am not convinced that the school should reopen next year. The death of the headmaster at the hands of one of our colleagues is a terrible stain upon Hogwarts history. It is horrible. I am sure Dumbledore would have wanted the school to remain open, said Professor Sprout. "I feel that if a single pupil wants to come, then the school ought to remain open for that pupil."
"But will we have a single pupil after this?"
said Slughorn, now dabbing his sweating brow with a silken handkerchief.
"Parents will want to keep their children at home, and I can't say I blame them. Personally, I don't think we're in more danger at Hogwarts than we are anywhere else, but you can't expect mothers to think like that. They'll want to keep their families together. It's only natural."
"I agree," said Professor McGonagall. "And in any case, it is not true to say that Dumbledore never envisaged the situation in which Hogwarts might close. When the Chamber of Secrets reopened, he considered the closure of the school, and I must say that Professor Dumbledore's murder is more disturbing to me than the idea of Slytherin's monster living undetected in the bowels of the castle."
"We must consult the governors," said Professor Flitwick in his squeaky little voice.
He had a large bruise on his forehead, but seemed otherwise unscathed by his collapse in Snape's office.
"We must follow the established procedures. A decision should not be made hastily."
"Hagrid, you haven't said anything," said Professor McGonagall. "What are your views? Ought Hogwarts to remain open?" Hagrid, who had been weeping silently into his large spotted handkerchief throughout this conversation, now raised puffy red eyes and croaked,
"I don't know, Professor. That's for the heads of house and the headmistress to decide."
"Professor Dumbledore always valued your views," said Professor McGonagall kindly, "and so do I."
"Well, I'm staying,"
said Hagrid, fat tears still leaking out of the corners of his eyes and trickling down into his tangled beard.
"It's me home. It's been me home since I was 13. And if there's kids who want me to teach 'em, I'll do it. But I dunno. Hogwarts without Dumbledore?"
He gulped and disappeared behind his handkerchief once more, and there was silence. "Very well," said Professor McGonagall, glancing out of the window at the grounds, checking to see whether the minister was yet approaching. "Then I must agree with Phileas that the right thing to do is to consult the governors, who will take the final decision. Now, as to getting students home, there is an argument for doing it sooner rather than later. We could arrange for the Hogwarts Express to come tomorrow, if necessary." "What about Dumbledore's funeral?" said Harry, speaking at last. "Well," said Professor McGonagall, losing a little of her briskness as her voice shook, I know that it was Dumbledore's wish to be laid to rest here at Hogwarts." "Then that's what'll happen, isn't it?" said Harry fiercely. "If the Ministry thinks it appropriate," said Professor McGonagall. "No other headmaster or headmistress has ever been—"
"No other headmaster or headmistress ever gave more to this school," growled Hagrid.
"Hogwarts should be Dumbledore's final resting place," said Professor Flitwick.
"Absolutely," said Professor Sprout.
"And in that case," said Harry, "you shouldn't send the students home until the funeral's over. They'll want to say—" The last word caught in his throat, but Professor Sprout completed the sentence for him.
"Goodbye."
"Well said," squeaked Professor Flitwick. "Well said indeed. Our students should pay tribute. It is fitting. We can arrange transport home afterwards."
"Seconded,"
barked Professor Sprout.
"I suppose—" "Yes," said Slughorn in a rather agitated voice, while Hagrid let out a strangled sob of assent. "He's coming," said Professor McGonagall suddenly, gazing down into the grounds. "The minister. And by the looks of it, he's brought a delegation."
"Can I leave, Professor?" said Harry at once. He had no desire at all to see or be interrogated by Rufus Scrimgeour tonight.
"You may," said Professor McGonagall. "And quickly."
She strode towards the door and held it open for him. He sped down the spiral staircase and off along the deserted corridor. He had left his invisibility cloak at the top of the astronomy tower, but it did not matter.
There was nobody in the corridors to see him pass, not even Filch, Mrs. Norris, or Peeves. He did not meet another soul until he turned into the passage leading to the Gryffindor common room.
"Is it true?"
whispered the fat lady as he approached her.
"Is it really true? Dumbledore dead?"
"Yes," said Harry. She let out a wail and, without waiting for the password, swung forwards to admit him. As Harry had suspected it would be, the common room was jam-packed. The room fell silent as he climbed through the portrait hole. He saw Dean and Seamus sitting in a group nearby. This meant that the dormitory must be empty, or nearly so. Without speaking to anybody, without making eye contact at all, Harry walked straight across the room and through the door to the boys' dormitories. As he had hoped, Ron was waiting for him, still fully dressed, sitting on his bed. Harry sat down on his own four-poster, and for a moment they simply stared at each other. "They're talking about closing the school," said Harry. "Lupin said they would," said Ron. There was a pause. "So?" said Ron in a very low voice, as though he thought the furniture might be listening in. "Did you find one? Did you get it? A Horcrux?" Harry shook his head. All that had taken place around that black lake seemed like an old nightmare now. Had it really happened? And only hours ago? "You didn't get it," said Ron, looking crestfallen. "It wasn't there." "No," said Harry. "Someone had already taken it and left a fake in its place."
"Already taken?"
Wordlessly, Harry pulled the fake locket from his pocket, opened it, and passed it to Ron. The full story could wait. It did not matter tonight. Nothing mattered except the end. The end of their pointless adventure. The end of Dumbledore's life.
"R.A.B.," whispered Ron. "But who was that?"
"Dunno," said Harry, lying back on his bed, fully clothed and staring blankly upwards. He felt no curiosity at all about R.A.B. He doubted that he would ever feel curious again. As he lay there, he became aware, suddenly, that the grounds were silent. Forks had stopped singing. And he knew, without knowing how he knew it, that the phoenix had gone, had left Hogwarts for good, just as Dumbledore had left the school, had left the world, had left Harry. Chapter 30. The White Tomb. All lessons were suspended, all examinations postponed. Some students were hurried away from Hogwarts by their parents over the next couple of days. The Patil twins were gone before breakfast on the morning following Dumbledore's death, and Zachariah Smith was escorted from the castle by his haughty-looking father. Seamus Finnegan, on the other hand, refused point-blank to accompany his mother home. They had a shouting match in the entrance hall, which was resolved when she agreed that he could remain behind for the funeral. She had difficulty in finding a bed in Hogsmeade, Seamus told Harry and Ron, for wizards and witches were pouring into the village, preparing to pay their last respects to Dumbledore. Some excitement was caused among the younger students, who had never seen it before, when a powder-blue carriage the size of a house, pulled by a dozen giant winged palominos, came soaring out of the sky in the late afternoon before the funeral, and landed on the edge of the forest. Harry watched from a window as a gigantic and handsome olive-skinned black-haired woman descended the carriage steps and threw herself into the waiting Hagrid's arms. Meanwhile,
a delegation of ministry officials, including the Minister for Magic himself, was being accommodated within the castle. Harry was diligently avoiding contact with any of them. He was sure that sooner or later he would be asked again to account for Dumbledore's last excursion from Hogwarts. Harry, Ron, Hermione and Ginny were spending all of their time together. The beautiful weather seemed to mock them. Harry could imagine how it would have been if Dumbledore had not died, and they had had this time together at the very end of the year, Ginny's examinations finished, the pressure of homework lifted, and hour by hour he put off saying the thing that he knew he must say, doing what he knew it was right to do, because it was too hard to forego his best source of comfort. They visited the hospital wing twice a day. Neville had been discharged, but Bill remained under Madame Pumphrey's care. His scars were as bad as ever. In truth, he now bore a distinct resemblance to Mad-Eye Moody, though thankfully with both eyes and legs. But in personality, he seemed just the same as ever. All that appeared to have changed was that he now had a great liking for very rare steaks. "So it is lucky he is marrying me," said Fleur happily, plumping up Bill's pillows, "because the British overcook their meat. I have always said this."
"I suppose I'm just going to have to accept that he really is going to marry her,"
sighed Ginny later that evening, as she, Harry, Ron and Hermione sat beside the open window of the Gryffindor common room, looking out over the twilit grounds. "She's not that bad," said Harry.
"Ugly, though,"
he added hastily, as Ginny raised her eyebrows, and she let out a reluctant giggle.
"Well, I suppose if Mum can stand it, I can."
"Anyone else we know died?" Ron asked Hermione, who was perusing the Evening Prophet. Hermione winced at the forced toughness in his voice.
"No,"
she said reprovingly, folding up the newspaper. "They're still looking for Snape, but no sign."
"Of course there isn't," said Harry, who became angry every time this subject cropped up. "They won't find Snape till they find Voldemort, and seeing as they've never managed to do that in all this time..."
"I'm going to go to bed,"
yawned Ginny.
"I haven't been sleeping that well since... Well, I could do with some sleep."
She kissed Harry, Ron looked away pointedly, waved at the other two, and departed for the girls' dormitories. The moment the door had closed behind her, Hermione leaned forwards towards Harry with a most Hermione-ish look on her face.
"Harry, I found something out this morning in the library."
"R.A.B.," said Harry, sitting up straight. He did not feel the way he had so often felt before, excited, curious, burning to get to the bottom of a mystery. He simply knew that the task of discovering the truth about the real Horcrux had to be completed before he could move a little further along the dark and winding path stretching ahead of him, the path that he and Dumbledore had set out upon together, and which he now knew he would have to journey alone. There might still be as many as 4 Horcruxes out there somewhere, and each would need to be found and eliminated before there was even a possibility that Voldemort could be killed. He kept reciting their names to himself, as though by listing them he could bring them within reach. "The locket, the cup, the snake, something of Gryffindor's or Ravenclaw's, the locket, the cup, the snake, something of Gryffindor's or Ravenclaw's." This mantra seemed to pulse through Harry's mind as he fell asleep at night, and his dreams were thick with cups, lockets, and mysterious objects that he could not quite reach, though Dumbledore helpfully offered Harry a rope ladder that turned to snakes the moment he began to climb. He had shown Hermione the note inside the locket the morning after Dumbledore's death,
and although she had not immediately recognised the initials as belonging to some obscure wizard about whom she had been reading, she had since been rushing off to the library a little more often than was strictly necessary for somebody who had no homework to do.
"No," she said sadly. "I've been trying, Harry, but I haven't found anything. There are a couple of reasonably well-known wizards with those initials. Rosalind Antigone Bungs, Rupert Axbanger Brookstanton, but they don't seem to fit at all. Judging by that note, the person who stole the Horcrux knew Voldemort, and I can't find a shred of evidence that Bungs or Axbanger ever had anything to do with him. No, actually, it's about, well, Snape."
She looked nervous even saying the name again.
"What about him?" asked Harry heavily, slumping back in his chair.
"Well, it's just that I was sort of right about the Half-Blood Prince business," she said tentatively.
"Do you have to rub it in, Hermione? How do you think I feel about that now?"
"No, no, Harry, I didn't mean that,"
she said hastily, looking around to check that they were not being overheard.
"It's just that I was right about Eileen Prince once owning the book. You see, she was Snape's mother."
"I thought she wasn't much of a looker," said Ron. Hermione ignored him.
"I was going through the rest of the old prophets, and there was a tiny announcement about Eileen Prince marrying a man called Tobias Snape, and then later an announcement saying that she'd given birth to a
murderer," spat Harry.
"Well, yes," said Hermione. "So I was sort of right. Snape must have been proud of being half a prince, you see. Tobias Snape was a muggle, from what it said in the prophet."
"Yeah, that fits," said Harry. "He'd play up the pure blood side so he could get in with Lucius Malfoy and the rest of them. He's just like Voldemort. Pure blood mother, muggle father, ashamed of his parentage, trying to make himself feared using the dark arts. Gave himself an impressive new name, Lord Voldemort, the Half-Blood Prince. How could Dumbledore have missed—"
He broke off, looking out of the window. He could not stop himself dwelling upon Dumbledore's inexcusable trust in Snape. But as Hermione had just inadvertently reminded him, he, Harry, had been taken in just the same. In spite of the increasing nastiness of those scribbled spells, he had refused to believe ill of the boy who had been so clever, who had helped him so much. Helped him. It was an almost unendurable thought now.
"I still don't get why he didn't turn you in for using that book," said Ron. "He must have known where you were getting it all from."
"He knew," said Harry bitterly.
"He knew when I used Sectum Sempra. He didn't really need Legilimency. He might even have known before then, with Slughorn talking about how brilliant I was at potions. Shouldn't have left his old book in the bottom of that cupboard, should he?"
"But why didn't he turn you in?"
"I don't think he wanted to associate himself with that book," said Hermione. "I don't think Dumbledore would have liked it very much if he'd known. And even if Snape pretended it hadn't been his, Slughorn would have recognised his writing at once. Anyway, the book was left in Snape's old classroom, and I'll bet Dumbledore knew his mother was called Prince."
"I should have shown the book to Dumbledore," said Harry. "All that time he was showing me how Voldemort was evil, even when he was at school. And I had proof Snape was, too."
"Evil is a strong word," said Hermione quietly.
"You were the one who kept telling me the book was dangerous."
"I'm trying to say, Harry, that you're putting too much blame on yourself. I thought the prince seemed to have a nasty sense of humour, but I would never have guessed he was a potential killer."
"None of us could have guessed Snape would, you know," said Ron.
Silence fell between them, each of them lost in their own thoughts. But Harry was sure that they, like him, were thinking about the following morning, when Dumbledore's body would be laid to rest. Harry had never attended a funeral before. There had been no body to bury when Sirius had died.
He did not know what to expect, and was a little worried about what he might see, about how he would feel. He wondered whether Dumbledore's death would be more real to him once the funeral was over. Though he had moments when the horrible fact of it threatened to overwhelm him, there were blank stretches of numbness where, despite the fact that nobody was talking about anything else in the whole castle, he still found it difficult to believe that Dumbledore had really gone. Admittedly, he had not, as he had with Sirius, looked desperately for some kind of loophole, some way that Dumbledore would come back. He felt in his pocket for the cold chain of the fake Horcrux, which he now carried with him everywhere, not as a talisman, but as a reminder of what it had cost, and what remained still to do. Harry rose early to pack the next day. The Hogwarts Express would be leaving an hour after the funeral. Downstairs, he found the mood in the great hall subdued. Everybody was wearing their dress robes, and no one seemed very hungry. Professor McGonagall had left the throne-like chair in the middle of the staff table empty. Hagrid's chair was deserted too. Harry thought that perhaps he had not been able to face breakfast. But Snape's place had been unceremoniously filled by Rufus Scrimgeour. Harry avoided his yellowish eyes as they scanned the hall. Harry had the uncomfortable feeling that Scrimgeour was looking for him. Among Scrimgeour's entourage, Harry spotted the red hair and horn-rimmed glasses of Percy Weasley. Ron gave no sign that he was aware of Percy, apart from stabbing pieces of kipper with unwonted venom. Over at the Slytherin table, Crabbe and Goyle were muttering together. Hulking boys though they were, they looked oddly lonely without the tall, pale figure of Malfoy between them, bossing them around. Harry had not spared Malfoy much thought. His animosity was all for Snape, but he had not forgotten the fear in Malfoy's voice on that tower top, nor the fact that he had lowered his wand before the other Death Eaters arrived. Harry did not believe that Malfoy would have killed Dumbledore. He despised Malfoy still for his infatuation with the dark arts, but now the tiniest drop of pity mingled with his dislike. Where, Harry wondered, was Malfoy now, and what was Voldemort making him do under threat of killing him and his parents? Harry's thoughts were interrupted by a nudge in the ribs from Ginny. Professor McGonagall had risen to her feet, and the mournful hum in the hall died away at once.
"It is nearly time," she said. "Please follow your heads of house out into the grounds. Gryffindors, after me."
They filed out from behind their benches in near silence. Harry glimpsed Slughorn at the head of the Slytherin column, wearing magnificent long emerald-green robes embroidered with silver. He had never seen Professor Sprout, head of the Hufflepuffs, looking so clean. There was not a single patch on her hat. And when they reached the entrance hall, they found Madame Pince standing beside Filch, she in a thick black veil that fell to her knees, he in an ancient black suit and tie, reeking of mothballs. They were heading, as Harry saw when he stepped out onto the stone steps from the front doors, towards the lake. The warmth of the sun caressed his face as they followed Professor McGonagall in silence to the place where hundreds of chairs had been set out in rows. An aisle ran down the centre of them. There was a marble table standing at the front, all chairs facing it. It was the most beautiful summer's day. An extraordinary assortment of people had already settled into half of the chairs, shabby and smart, old and young. Most Harry did not recognise, but there were a few that he did, including members of the Order of the Phoenix, Kingsley Shacklebolt, Mad-Eye Moody, Tonks, her hair miraculously returned to vividest pink, Remus Lupin, with whom she seemed to be holding hands, Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, Bill, supported by Fleur and followed by Fred and George, who were wearing jackets of black dragon skin. Then there was Madame Maxime, who took up 2½ chairs on her own, Tom, the landlord of the Leaky Cauldron, Arabella Fig, Harry's squib neighbour, the hairy bass player from the wizarding group The Weird Sisters, Ernie Prang, driver of the night bus, Madame Malkin of the robe shop in Diagon Alley, and some people whom Harry merely knew by sight, such as the barman of the Hog's Head and the witch who pushed the trolley on the Hogwarts Express. The castle ghosts were there too, barely visible in the bright sunlight, discernible only when they moved, shimmering insubstantially in the gleaming air. Harry, Ron, Hermione and Ginny filed into seats at the end of a row beside the lake. People were whispering to each other. It sounded like a breeze in the grass, but the birdsong was louder by far. The crowd continued to swell. With a great rush of affection for both of them, Harry saw Neville being helped into a seat by Luna. They alone, of all the D.A., had responded to Hermione's summons the night that Dumbledore had died, and Harry knew why. They were the ones who had missed the D.A. most, probably the ones who had checked their coins regularly in the hope that there would be another meeting. Cornelius Fudge walked past them towards the front rows, his expression miserable, twirling his green bowler hat as usual. Harry next recognised Rita Skeeter, who, he was infuriated to see, had a notebook clutched in her red-taloned hand. And then, with a worse jolt of fury, Dolores Umbridge, an unconvincing expression of grief upon her toad-like face, a black velvet bow set atop her iron-coloured curls. At the sight of the centaur Firenze, who was standing like a sentinel near the water's edge, she gave a start and scurried hastily into a seat a good distance away. The staff were seated at last. Harry could see Scrimgeour looking grave and dignified in the front row with Professor McGonagall. He wondered whether Scrimgeour, or any of these important people, were really sorry that Dumbledore was dead. But then he heard music, strange, otherworldly music, and he forgot his dislike of the ministry in looking around for the source of it. He was not the only one. Many heads were turning, searching, a little alarmed. "In there," whispered Ginny in Harry's ear. And he saw them in the clear green sunlit water, inches below the surface, reminding him horribly of the Inferi. A chorus of mer-people singing in a strange language he did not understand, their pallid faces rippling, their purplish hair flowing all around them. The music made the hair on Harry's neck stand up, and yet it was not unpleasant. It spoke very clearly of loss and of despair. As he looked down into the wild faces of the singers, he had the feeling that they, at least, were sorry for Dumbledore's passing. Then Ginny nudged him again, and he looked round. Hagrid was walking slowly up the aisle between the chairs. He was crying quite silently, his face gleaming with tears, and in his arms, wrapped in purple velvet, spangled with golden stars, was what Harry knew to be Dumbledore's body. A sharp pain rose in Harry's throat at this sight. For a moment, the strange music and the knowledge that Dumbledore's body was so close seemed to take all warmth from the day. Ron looked white and shocked.
tears were falling thick and fast into both Ginny and Hermione's laps. They could not see clearly what was happening at the front. Hagrid seemed to have placed the body carefully upon the table. Now he retreated down the aisle, blowing his nose with loud trumpeting noises that drew scandalized looks from some, including, Harry saw, Dolores Umbridge. But Harry knew that Dumbledore would not have cared. He tried to make a friendly gesture to Hagrid as he passed, but Hagrid's eyes were so swollen it was a wonder he could see where he was going. Harry glanced at the back row to which Hagrid was heading, and realized what was guiding him, for there, dressed in a jacket and trousers each the size of a small marquee, was the giant Grawp, his great, ugly, boulder-like head bowed, docile, almost human. Hagrid sat down next to his half-brother, and Grawp patted Hagrid hard on the head, so that his chair legs sank into the ground. Harry had a wonderful, momentary urge to laugh. But then the music stopped, and he turned to face the front again. A little tufty-haired man in plain black robes had got to his feet and stood now in front of Dumbledore's body. Harry could not hear what he was saying. Odd words floated back to them over the hundreds of heads. Nobility of spirit, intellectual contribution, greatness of heart. It did not mean very much. It had little to do with Dumbledore as Harry had known him. He suddenly remembered Dumbledore's idea of a few words, nitwit, oddment, blubber, and tweak, and again had to suppress a grin. What was the matter with him? There was a soft splashing noise to his left, and he saw that the merpeople had broken the surface to listen too. He remembered Dumbledore crouching at the water's edge 2 years ago, very close to where Harry now sat, and conversing in Murmish with the mer-chieftainess. Harry wondered where Dumbledore had learned Murmish. There was so much he had never asked him, so much he should have said. And then, without warning, it swept over him, the dreadful truth, more completely and undeniably than it had until now. Dumbledore was dead. Gone. He clutched the cold locket in his hand so tightly that it hurt, but he could not prevent hot tears spilling from his eyes. He looked away from Ginny and the others and stared out over the lake, towards the forest, as the little man in black droned on. There was movement among the trees. The centaurs had come to pay their respects too. They did not move into the open, but Harry saw them standing quite still, half hidden in shadow, watching the wizards, their bows hanging at their sides. And Harry remembered his first nightmarish trip into the forest, the first time he had ever encountered the thing that was then Voldemort, and how he had faced him, and how he and Dumbledore had discussed fighting a losing battle not long thereafter. It was important, Dumbledore said, to fight, and fight again, and keep fighting, for only then could evil be kept at bay, though never quite eradicated. And Harry saw very clearly, as he sat there under the hot sun, how people who cared about him had stood in front of him one by one, his mother, his father, his godfather, and finally Dumbledore, all determined to protect him. But now that was over. He could not let anybody else stand between him and Voldemort. He must abandon forever the illusion he ought to have lost at the age of one, that the shelter of a parent's arms meant that nothing could hurt him.
There was no waking from his nightmare, no comforting whisper in the dark that he was safe, really, that it was all in his imagination. The last and greatest of his protectors had died, and he was more alone than he had ever been before. The little man in black had stopped speaking at last and resumed his seat. Harry waited for somebody else to get to their feet. He expected speeches, probably from the minister, but nobody moved. Then several people screamed. Bright white flames had erupted around Dumbledore's body and the table upon which it lay. Higher and higher they rose, obscuring the body. White smoke spiraled into the air and made strange shapes. Harry thought, for one heart-stopping moment, that he saw a phoenix fly joyfully into the blue, but next second the fire had vanished. In its place was a white marble tomb, encasing Dumbledore's body and the table on which he had rested. There were a few more cries of shock as a shower of arrows soared through the air, but they fell far short of the crowd. It was, Harry knew, the centaur's tribute. He saw them turn tail and disappear back into the cool trees. Likewise, the merpeople sank slowly back into the green water and were lost from view. Harry looked at Ginny, Ron and Hermione. Ron's face was screwed up, as though the sunlight was blinding him. Hermione's face was glazed with tears. But Ginny was no longer crying. She met Harry's gaze with the same hard, blazing look that he had seen when she had hugged him after winning the Quidditch Cup in his absence. And he knew that at that moment they understood each other perfectly, and that when he told her what he was going to do now, she would not say, "Be careful," or "Don't do it," but accept his decision, because she would not have expected anything less of him. And so he steeled himself to say what he had known he must say ever since Dumbledore had died. "Ginny, listen," he said very quietly, as the buzz of conversation grew louder around them and people began to get to their feet. "I can't be involved with you any more. We've got to stop seeing each other. We can't be together." She said, with an oddly twisted smile, "It's for some stupid, noble reason, isn't it?" "It's been like something out of someone else's life these last few weeks with you," said Harry. "But I can't. We can't. I've got things to do alone now." She did not cry. She simply looked at him. "Voldemort uses people his enemies are close to. He's already used you as bait once, and that was just because you're my best friend's sister. Think how much danger you'll be in if we keep this up. He'll know. He'll find out. He'll try and get to me through you." "What if I don't care?" said Ginny fiercely. "I care," said Harry. "How do you think I'd feel if this was your funeral and it was my fault?" She looked away from him, over the lake. "I never really gave up on you," she said. "Not really. I always hoped. Hermione told me to get on with life, maybe go out with some other people, relax a bit around you, because I never used to be able to talk if you were in the room, remember? And she thought you might take a bit more notice if I was a bit more myself." "Smart girl, that Hermione," said Harry, trying to smile. "I just wish I'd asked you sooner. We could have had ages, months, years maybe." "But you've been too busy saving the wizarding world," said Ginny, half laughing. "Well,
I can't say I'm surprised. I knew this would happen in the end. I knew you wouldn't be happy unless you were hunting Voldemort. Maybe that's why I like you so much.
Harry could not bear to hear these things, nor did he think his resolution would hold if he remained sitting beside her. Ron, he saw, was now holding Hermione and stroking her hair while she sobbed into his shoulder, tears dripping from the end of his own long nose. With a miserable gesture, Harry got up, turned his back on Ginny and on Dumbledore's tomb, and walked away around the lake. Moving felt much more bearable than sitting still, just as setting out as soon as possible to track down the Horcruxes and kill Voldemort would feel better than waiting to do it.
Harry!
He turned. Rufus Scrimgeour was limping rapidly towards him around the bank, leaning on his walking stick.
I've been hoping to have a word. Do you mind if I walk a little way with you?
No, said Harry indifferently, and set off again.
Harry, this was a dreadful tragedy, said Scrimgeour quietly. I cannot tell you how appalled I was to hear of it. Dumbledore was a very great wizard. We had our disagreements, as you know, but no one knows better than I.
What do you want? Asked Harry flatly. Scrimgeour looked annoyed, but, as before, hastily modified his expression to one of sorrowful understanding.
You are, of course, devastated, he said. I know that you were very close to Dumbledore. I think you may have been his favourite ever pupil. The bond between the two of you...
What do you want? Harry repeated, coming to a halt. Scrimgeour stopped too, leaned on his stick, and stared at Harry, his expression shrewd now.
The word is that you were with him when he left the school the night that he died.
Whose word? Said Harry.
Somebody stupefied a Death Eater on top of the tower after Dumbledore died. There were also two broomsticks up there. The Ministry can add two and two, Harry.
Glad to hear it, said Harry. Well, where I went with Dumbledore and what we did is my business. He didn't want people to know.
Such loyalty is admirable, of course, said Scrimgeour, who seemed to be restraining his irritation with difficulty. But Dumbledore is gone, Harry. He's gone.
He will only be gone from the school when none here are loyal to him, said Harry, smiling in spite of himself.
My dear boy, even Dumbledore cannot return from the...
I'm not saying he can. You wouldn't understand. But I've got nothing to tell you. Scrimgeour hesitated, then said, in what was evidently supposed to be a tone of delicacy,
The Ministry can offer you all sorts of protection, you know, Harry. I would be delighted to place a couple of my aurors at your service.
Harry laughed.
Voldemort wants to kill me himself, and aurors won't stop him.
So thanks for the offer, but no thanks.
So, said Scrimgeour, his voice cold now, the request I made of you at Christmas...
What request? Oh, yeah, the one where I tell the world what a great job you're doing in exchange for...
For raising everyone's morale, snapped Scrimgeour.
Harry considered him for a moment. Released Stan Shunpike yet? Scrimgeour turned a nasty purple colour, highly reminiscent of Uncle Vernon.
I see you are
Dumbledore's man through and through, said Harry. That's right. Scrimgeour glared at him for another moment, then turned and limped away without another word. Harry could see Percy and the rest of the Ministry delegation waiting for him, casting nervous glances at the sobbing Hagrid and Grawp, who were still in their seats. Ron and Hermione were hurrying towards Harry, passing Scrimgeour going in the opposite direction. Harry turned and walked slowly on, waiting for them to catch up, which they finally did in the shade of a beech tree under which they had sat in happier times.
"What did Scrimgeour want?"
Hermione whispered. "Same as he wanted at Christmas," shrugged Harry. "Wanted me to give him inside information on Dumbledore and be the Ministry's new poster boy." Ron seemed to struggle with himself for a moment. Then he said loudly to Hermione,
"Look, let me go back and hit Percy."
"No," she said firmly, grabbing his arm.
"It'll make me feel better."
Harry laughed. Even Hermione grinned a little, though her smile faded as she looked up at the castle.
"I can't bear the idea that we might never come back," she said softly. "How can Hogwarts close?"
"Maybe it won't," said Ron. "We're not in any more danger here than we are at home, are we? Everywhere's the same now. I'd even say Hogwarts is safer. There are more wizards inside to defend the place. What do you reckon, Harry?"
"I'm not coming back, even if it does reopen," said Harry.
Ron gaped at him, but Hermione said sadly, "I knew you were going to say that.
But then what will you do?"
"I'm going back to the Dursleys once more, because Dumbledore wanted me to," said Harry. "But it'll be a short visit, and then I'll be gone for good."
"But where will you go if you don't come back to school?"
"I thought I might go back to Godric's Hollow," Harry muttered. He had had the idea in his head ever since the night of Dumbledore's death. "For me, it started there, all of it. I've just got a feeling I need to go there, and I can visit my parents' graves. I'd like that."
"And then what?" said Ron.
"Then I've got to track down the rest of the Horcruxes, haven't I?" said Harry, his eyes upon Dumbledore's white tomb, reflected in the water on the other side of the lake. "That's what he wanted me to do. That's why he told me all about them. If Dumbledore was right, and I'm sure he was, there are still four of them out there. I've got to find them and destroy them, and then I've got to go after the seventh bit of Voldemort's soul, the bit that's still in his body, and I'm the one who's going to kill him. And if I meet Severus Snape along the way," he added, "so much the better for me. So much the worse for him." There was a long silence. The crowd had almost dispersed now, the stragglers giving the monumental figure of Grawp a wide berth as he cuddled Hagrid, whose howls of grief were still echoing across the water.
"We'll be there, Harry," said Ron.
"What?"
"At your aunt and uncle's house," said Ron. "And then we'll go with you, wherever you're going."
"No," said Harry quickly. He had not counted on this. He had meant them to understand that he was undertaking this most dangerous journey alone.
"You said to us once before," said Hermione quietly, "that there was time to turn back if we wanted to. We've had time, haven't we?"
"We're with you, whatever happens," said Ron. "But, mate, you're going to have to come round my mum and dad's house before we do anything else, even Godric's Hollow."
"Why?"
"Bill and Fleur's wedding, remember?"
Harry looked at him, startled. The idea that anything as normal as a wedding could still exist seemed incredible and yet wonderful.
"Yeah. We shouldn't miss that," he said, finally. His hand closed automatically around the fake Horcrux. But in spite of everything, in spite of the dark and twisting path he saw stretching ahead for himself, in spite of the final meeting with Voldemort he knew must come, whether in a month, in a year, or in 10, he felt his heart lift at the thought that there was still one last golden day of peace
left to enjoy with Ron and Hermione. The end.